pleasure to be here. Although it's been quite a while, I have visited Westminster on a number of occasions in the past, and I have always thought of this as just an absolutely wonderful church that does great outreach, is welcoming, and so it's really an honor to be asked back to speak to you. Today I'm going to talk about the first 76 years in the life of Jorge Mario Bergoglio, which explain what we'll cover next week in his 4 years as Pope Francis. He is a man of extraordinary courage and of these, and was careful never to confuse the gospel with any ideology of the right or the left. This often pitted him against the government in Argentina, and sometimes against some in his own church, who tried to silence him. But when he was able to minister freely, great revivals of faith followed, together with civic efforts to cross party lines and to build a society that would serve the common good. For much of today's material, I am deeply indebted to the journalist Austin Iverly and his book, The Great Reformer, Pope Francis, which I highly recommend. And by the way, if you're interested in the Pope's daily activities, there is an app for that. Called the Pope app. You can download it. It's great. Or you can go to www.news.va. Seeds of his pontificate were sown with the emigration of his paternal grandparents and their 6 children from Italy to Argentina in 1926. They were not poor. They owned a coffee shop in Turin. But they were members of Catholic Action, people who worked for social justice in alliance with the church, and they were persecuted by Mussolini and his fascist black shirts. Argentina then had one of the world's strongest economies, and the Bergoglios had relatives there. They bought 8 steerage tickets on a ship, the Princess Mafalda, but traded them for a later ship due to a delay in the sale of their coffee shop. The Princess Mafalda never made it to Argentina. She sank off Brazil. Nearly all the steerage passengers drowned, 500 of them. And today, when Pope Francis points to the bodies of migrants washed up on the shores around the Mediterranean, he sees what might have been his own father and grandparents. The family did well in Argentina until the Great Depression, when they lost everything, their jobs, their home. They moved from a smaller city to Buenos Aires. There, a parish priest of the Salesian order, Father Enrico Pozzoli, arranged a small loan to help the Bergoglios open a cafe. They began to rebuild their lives. In 1932, the Pope's father, Mario, married his mother, Regina, and Jorge, the first of their 5 children, was born in 1936. His grandmother, Rosa, a longtime member of Catholic Action, taught Jorge to pray, took him to Mass, gave him a great love for the saints. She had a neighborly view of Protestants, Jews, and divorced people, which was unusual for Catholics in that era. Meanwhile, Argentina entered into political upheaval that has arguably never ended. As a teenager, Jorge became deeply involved in Catholic Action. Members studied Catholic social teaching and strove to apply it to their lives and communities. They called for reforms such as an 8-hour workday or a 6-day workweek with Sundays off. In 1943, an army officer named Juan Perón led a military coup. Now, I've always been puzzled by what came to be called Peronism, because I could never figure out, was it left wing, was it right wing? And what I learned from studying Pope Francis was that it was both. It was organized around the person of Peron, and as he changed, so did Peronism, while people who associated with the movement at different points in its history called themselves Peronists, despite often radically opposing viewpoints. At first, Perón seemed to be in the Catholic social justice tradition. He was friendly to the church, he was concerned for the rights of workers and the poor. But when he tried to assert political power over the church, the bishops resisted. He began to treat the church as an enemy. He even portrayed himself as Christ and his wife, Evita, as the new Virgin Mary. This did not go over well. He banned Catholic action. He outlawed public expressions of faith. His thugs broke up masses. Church protests took the form of religious processions, carrying the Blessed Sacrament and images of the saints. After such a procession of about 150,000 people, Perón's people, his agents, arrested many priests. They bombed the Plaza de Mayo, the central square in Buenos Aires, where both the cathedral and the Argentinian equivalent of the White House is. 12 churches in Buenos Aires were set on fire. Another military coup in 1955 drove Perón into exile in Spain. The Peronist Party was banned, and the new military governors persecuted his followers so severely that there came to be great sympathy for Perón and his movement, and they became a rallying point for those who wanted to end the military dictatorship. An armed guerrilla resistance formed, which specialized in urban terrorism. Meanwhile, while this is going on, Jorge stayed involved in Catholic action. He was unusually devout, leading teenage friends into the church, preparing them for confirmation, and serving as their sponsor. At the same time, he had an active social life. He loved to dance, especially the tango, and worked for a while at a tango club. He went to an elite public high school from which he graduated with, there's no real equivalent to what he had in our country, but it was sort of like he graduated with an associate's degree in chemistry. His parents wanted him to be a doctor. During and immediately after high school, he worked in a chemistry lab. His boss, Esther Balestrino, was a communist who had fled the dictatorship in her native Paraguay. She taught him how to do proper scientific research, and she became his friend. He never agreed with Marxism, but she challenged him to think more deeply about political systems. She would emerge later in his life as a founder of the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, who protested on behalf of loved ones who had disappeared under a later military dictatorship. One morning, when he was nearly 17, he was walking with his girlfriend when they passed a church. It wasn't his church, but he felt a strange urgency to go inside. When he saw a priest enter a confessional, he followed. We don't know what transpired, except that Pope Francis considers that confession a great transformational moment of his life. He emerged certain of his call to the priesthood. His mother was so devastated by that that she didn't visit him during the 13 years he spent in seminary. They reconciled on the day he was ordained. In 1956, when he was 20, he entered the diocesan seminary, but he became attracted to a young woman and considered leaving. While he was wrestling with this decision, he became extremely ill and nearly died of pleurisy. Part of his right lung was removed. When he recovered, he applied to and entered the Jesuits. He was drawn to their commitment to serve the poor, to their missionary spirit and their spirituality, which focuses on how to discern God's will from the temptations of Satan. The central text for this is the Spiritual Exercises of St. Ignatius. It's really deep stuff that leads people to confront their own sins, experience the loving mercy of Jesus, and seek to discern what he is calling them to. Such discernment would be a central focus of his ministry as priest, bishop, and pope. Most of those with whom he entered the Jesuit seminary dropped out. The church was in turmoil following Vatican II. Most people think of Vatican II, if they think of it at all, as the three-year-long meeting that changed the church from having services in Latin to the local language. But the changes were much deeper. Pope John XXIII, who Pope Francis has canonized, called the council in 1962 to recover the early teachings of the church before they were encrusted with centuries of cultural residue and to apply them to contemporary life. The church was to be engaged in the culture rather than standing outside and condemning it in order to invite people to follow Jesus. Vatican II had a particular call for religious orders. Each order is founded for a certain mission, whether that is silent prayer or serving elderly people or something else. But many religious orders had become sidetracked from their original mission. Vatican II called them to recover that mission and carry it out. There were terrible divisions within religious communities about how to press forward. For instance, because their habits weren't originally countercultural, but were simple, uniform versions of whatever the local dress was in the time and place they were from, many orders stopped wearing the long robes and the funny-looking bonnets and began to dress in simple contemporary clothing. A lot of them felt this wasn't what they had signed up for, and many, many priests, monks, and nuns left in the 1970s. Bergoglio was never tempted to leave after his initial crisis, but his ministry would be marked and sometimes devastated by the divisions that followed Vatican II. Through it all, he sought to be an instrument of unity in the name of Jesus, encouraging what he called reconciled diversity. He was greatly influenced by a book, True and False Reform in the Church, by Yves Congar, a theological architect of Vatican II. It examined why some reform movements breed division, corruption, abuse of power, and schism, while others produce holiness and evangelization. The most important element of healthy reform, Congar wrote, was pastoral concern for real issues in the real lives of ordinary people. Healthy reform valued tradition, from core doctrines to pious practices, above innovations. And healthy reform was rooted in faithfulness to the gospel of Jesus Christ, not to any political or ideological movement. These became guiding principles for Bergoglio. He saw all political ideologies as competitors to the gospel and insisted that the gospel could not be repackaged as political philosophy, whether Marxist or capitalist. In the 1970s, this put him on a collision course with some Jesuits. Latin American theologians were creating what is usually called liberation theology, but is actually really multiple liberation theologies. What these all shared and what would be ingrained in papal teaching by Pope John Paul II and subsequent popes was the preferential option for the poor. This meant that every policy or program must be evaluated first by the impact that it would have on the poor and rejected if it would hurt them. Another idea shared by all of the liberation theologies and embraced by the popes was that sin wasn't purely personal. There could be societal structures that were sinful because they harmed people and even forced them to sin. However, some liberation theologies sought to integrate Christianity with a Marxist analysis of society. They viewed the world through a lens of class conflict. Some of their followers concluded that the only way to eliminate structural sin was literal class warfare. Salvation meant political revolution. And I have to say, this was usually taking place in really horrible societies with governments that were killing people, and you can understand why they felt that way. But this call to war and the tendency to view people only as members of a class rather than as individuals with souls and rights led the Latin American bishops and Pope John Paul II to condemn Marxist forms of liberation theology. Unfortunately, the media often took this as a blanket condemnation of all liberation theology. In 1968, the bishops of Latin America met in Medellin, Colombia, and produced a document that has made a deep impact on official Catholic teaching. It shaped the concepts of the preferential option for the poor and of structural evil, while condemning both Marxism and unrestrained capitalism. Bergoglio's ministry was rooted in what came to be called simply Medellin. He was ordained in 1969 and took his final vows as a Jesuit in 1971. At the extraordinarily young age of 35, he was appointed to the only office he is ever known to have wanted, novice master. A novice master guides the newest members of religious orders, shaping their understanding of community life and of ministry. He felt that his own formation had been too rigid and academic, and he wanted to reform the novitiate according to the vision of Vatican II. The next year, he was appointed to the consultors who advised the Jesuit provincial, the superior of all the Jesuits in Argentina. A year later, that provincial was forced to step down due to serious divisions in the community, lack of vocations, financial problems, and a perception that he had allowed Marxist priests to run amok. Bergoglio was chosen to replace him. He has said as Pope that he was too young and far too authoritarian, but by most measures, his term in office was a great success. His basic principles for leadership were: unity comes before conflict, meaning that unity is the priority. The whole comes before the part. Reality comes before idea, meaning that people's lived experience is more important than abstract theories. And time comes before space. I've never found a really good definition of that one, but at least part of its meaning is that spending time with people is more important than having a building to do it in. This was an expression of what's come to be known as Pueblo theology, or people theology. Rather than focusing on problems that ailed a society, it was centered on what Pope Francis calls God's holy, faithful people. That meant people of any background or class who strove to do what was right and good in a difficult and dangerous world. Pueblo theology generally views Marxism as an attempt by elitist academics to determine how the common people should live, rather than trusting them to discern that for themselves. It also places a tremendous importance on the heartfelt religious practices of everyday Catholics, such as praying the rosary, devotions to saints, pilgrimages, public processions. That was the theological framework that Bergoglio brought to his ministry as provincial. Some of his initial moves to solve the financial problems, such as turning a university over to lay leadership, mortally offended a group of Marxist and left-leaning Jesuits. But he redeployed more priests to the slums, but he also closed an experimental Jesuit community that was Marxist in outlook, antagonistic toward the bishop, and friendly to the guerrillas. The anger of those Jesuits would have major repercussions. He reformed both the vocations, what you might call the recruitment program, and the spiritual formation program for Jesuits in training. A team of priests led youth retreats while he got large numbers of people to pray for more men to become Jesuits. New seminarians skyrocketed from virtually none to an average of more than 30 per year, which was more than they had in the 1950s. Defections all but ended. His vocations director was invited to Rome to share the secrets of their success. In the seminary, he replaced a lot of arcane theology with Jesuit spiritual classics and Argentine history and literature. He wanted the seminarians to understand the faith and the people they served with their heart, not just their head. His Jesuits were taught to encourage and practice popular expressions of piety, such as devotion to the saints and pilgrimages to local shrines. Devotion to the saints is important to his life, and I want to pause to explain it to those for whom it is unfamiliar. Catholics don't worship saints. Prayer to saints is based on the communion of saints, which you find in the earliest creeds of the Church. Catholic and Orthodox Christians understand this as a living relationship between all Christians, including the dead, who can pray for each other. Now, many of us ask other people, especially those who we consider especially faithful, to pray for us. That's what prayer to saints is. It's a request to an especially holy person who is now in the presence of God to pray for our concerns. While the saints were at the heart of most common Catholics' piety, some priests saw them as the kind of cultural accretions that Vatican II had sought to get rid of. Bergoglio's seminarians prayed to saints and engaged in missionary outreach. They knocked on doors to invite children to religious education classes. The parents followed. Mass attendance grew so much that new churches and mission chapels were built around the seminary. All this was criticized by left-leaning Jesuits who found popular devotions déclassé. They argued that it was the mission of the Salesians and other orders, not the Jesuits, to teach children. They felt that in his personal attention to poor individuals, Bergoglio was distracting the church from examining the reasons that these people were poor. All of this was happening against a bloody political backdrop. A return to civilian rule failed to stop the guerrilla violence. When Perón returned from exile to again become president, and when he landed at the airport, right-wing Peronists opened fire on left-wing Peronists, leaving many of them dead. Perón died the following year, and his widow, Isabel, countered left-wing terrorism with right-wing terrorism. Within months, her death squads assassinated nearly 500 people and disappeared another 2,000. The military seized power again in 1976. Over the next 8 years, in what is known as the Dirty War, Argentina turned disappeared from a verb to a noun. It described a government policy of kidnapping people to be secretly tortured, killed, and their bodies disposed of in secret. About half the 8,200 Argentinians killed were guerrillas. The others were merely suspected of collaborating with them. Priests, nuns, and lay Catholic leaders who worked in the slums were under constant suspicion, although few actually worked with the guerrillas. The church tried to help those who suffered. A few bishops with ties to the military collaborated with the government, but most were trying to save people. Three bishops, about 20 priests and nuns were killed outright, 84 disappeared, and 77 forced into exile. Hundreds of lay church workers suffered similar fates. Bergoglio personally assisted many fugitives, communists among them, and participated in a cross-continental underground railroad that the Jesuits ran to smuggle targeted people to safety in Europe. He did not publicly denounce the regime because if he had done so, every Jesuit in Argentina would have been targeted. He lived as he had since 1960 at the Jesuit seminary. He would smuggle fugitives in, often personally driving them, disguised as seminarians or retreatants. They hid in a wing for silent retreats while false identity papers were created. If he had been caught, he would have been killed. Bergoglio had his own resistance network. Military chaplains who on the surface appeared complicit with the junta would warn him of impending arrests so he could rescue people. At times, he literally threatened military officers with hell if they didn't free some innocent person, and sometimes that worked. One of the people he helped was his former boss from the chemistry lab, Esther. Initially, he hid her large collection of Marxist literature in his own library. She was one of the three founders of the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, who focused world attention on the dirty war by protesting in the square outside the president's office. Bergoglio had her smuggled to safety in Sweden, but Esther felt guilty about leaving and returned. She was kidnapped from a church along with several nuns, tortured, and killed. Bergoglio conducted a long search for her, but she was dead almost as soon as it began. Her remains were identified in 2005. Although Esther wasn't Catholic, he granted her daughter's request to bury her in the garden of the church from which she was abducted because it was the last place she had been free. The Dirty War ended in 1983. If Bergoglio was such a hero, Why have there been highly publicized claims that he was complicit in the kidnapping and torture of two of his priests? It's a highly complicated story rooted in his conflict with the Marxist Jesuits. And here is a somewhat oversimplified version. Three slum priests, including a Father Yorio and a Father Yalix, had Marxist sympathies and wanted to start a new kind of Jesuit community that was non-hierarchical and highly political, although there was no evidence that they ever supported the guerrillas. They fought with Bergoglio over this, challenged him in Rome, and regarded him as their enemy. Ultimately, Rome ordered Bergoglio to close their community. The three priests then decided to leave the Jesuits and start their own order. As conditions became more dangerous in the slums, Bergoglio begged them to seek shelter in the seminary, but they refused. Two of the three, Yorio and Yalix, were arrested, tortured, and kept chained and blindfolded for 5 months. Bergoglio worked vigorously to free them, at one point gaining an audience with an important military officer by trading places with a priest who was supposed to say mass at his home. Pope Paul called the commander-in-chief of the military on these two men's behalf. After they were freed, Yalix returned to the Jesuits and now lives in Germany. Yorio was initially grateful to Bergoglio, but soon turned against him. Some attribute that to a bad case of PTSD that escalated over the years. In his early accounts, complaining about Bergoglio, there is absolutely no mention of him, that Bergoglio had no claim that Bergoglio had collaborated with the military. That doesn't appear for another 10 years until investigations showed that some bishops had been complicit in human rights violations. Yorio, in collaboration with a journalist named Verbitsky, wove Bergoglio into that narrative. After Yorio died, Verbitsky continued to promote that myth. Multiple investigations, including one by Amnesty International, have concluded that Bergoglio never betrayed the priests or collaborated with the military. But in 1979, with the dirty war still raging, Bergoglio's term as provincial ended. He became rector of the Collegio Maximo, the seminary and study center where he had lived since 1960. Inflation was at 600%. Hunger was rampant. Addressing that was part of his students' formation. Bergoglio started a farm on 25 acres at the seminary. Seminarians worked it, and he worked alongside them, mucking out pigsties. This fed the students and the neighborhood. The students set up a tent kitchen that fed 400 children daily. On weekends, the students went door to door inviting people to Mass. He taught the seminarians that Catholics don't just show up at Mass because a church is nearby. They need to be invited by someone who has taken time to get to know them. They opened a night school for earning the equivalent of a GED, a vocational school for trades. They organized scholarships for poor kids to go to college. He emphasized that students should care personally for needy individuals, and he would help them find the resources necessary. The Collegio Maximo donated land to build a new church, which grew rapidly. There were 100 Jesuits in training when he became rector, twice that many when he stepped down in 1986. They had to expand the seminary. They shared in the pious practices of those they ministered to. Bergoglio knew that the faith of poor people who have a stark dependence on God was often deeper than that of many seminarians, and he believed that the faith of the poor would rub off on his future priests. It was this popular piety that most enraged his enemies among the Argentinian Jesuits. They told Jesuit headquarters in Rome that Bergoglio was a dangerous conservative who was offering students a retrograde pre-Vatican II formation. The global superior of the Jesuits intervened in the provincial election of 1986, imposing a new provincial who had been bitterly opposed to Bergoglio for years. He started to dismantle most of what Bergoglio had built. Seminarians were not to engage in manual labor or to knock on doors to invite people to church. He fired lay church workers who tried to continue what Bergoglio had started. Mass attendance dropped, churches closed. He shipped Bergoglio off to Germany to work on a doctorate. Bergoglio was miserable in Germany. One day he visited a Jesuit church in Augsburg that had an 18th century painting of Mary untangling a large knot of white ribbons. The story behind it was that a local couple had been on the brink of divorce when their parish priest prayed for Mary to, quote, untie all the knots in their troubled home. They were reconciled, and their grandson later commissioned the painting. A local devotion sprang up to Mary, Undoer of Knots, for help with complex, seemingly intractable problems, especially in marriage. After praying for hours before the painting, Bergoglio was certain he should return to Buenos Aires. He took with him a large package of holy cards of Mary, Undoer of Knots. He never got his doctorate. He taught for about 3 years at a Jesuit college and had a great following among younger Jesuits. This was seen as a threat by the provincial leadership, who scapegoated him for their troubles, including the fact that they were no longer getting many seminarians. In 1990, they removed him from his teaching post, banished him to a Jesuit residence outside Buenos Aires, and forbade him to visit the seminary where he had lived for a quarter century. His major supporters were sent to Europe. His other supporters were forbidden to contact him. He spent most of the next 2 years hearing confessions. He was traumatized and initially had trouble eating and sleeping. Everything he had loved and worked for was torn apart. The leaders he had trained were banished, and the province was divided. His relationship with the Jesuits would not heal until he became Pope. But more than a decade earlier, Bergoglio had impressed a bishop named Quarantino, who had since become Archbishop of Buenos Aires. In May 1992, Quarantino, despite fierce opposition, personally persuaded Pope John Paul II to make Bergoglio one of his auxiliary bishops. By this time, the Iron Curtain had fallen and Marxism had lost its teeth. Argentina had a conservative government that was counting on trickle-down economics to help the poor. But the poor got poorer. The Archbishop assigned him as regional vicar to the poorest quadrant of Buenos Aires and asked him to do there what he had seen him do in the communities around the seminary. Bergoglio tried to live as the common people did, traveling by bus and subway. He created a specialized team of slum priests skilled at ministry in the most challenging areas. About 18 months later, Cardinal Quarantino made him vicar general, essentially his chief of staff, spreading Bergoglio's influence around Buenos Aires. He introduced Buenos Aires to Mary, Undoer of Knots. Everywhere he went, he handed out holy cards with her image. One parish priest agreed to install a replica of the picture that was in Germany, although he had never heard of the devotion. He was shocked when 5,000 people showed up for the service of installation. Within a couple of years, that parish's annual celebration of Mary Undoer of Knots grew to more than 120,000 people. Two other saints are especially important to Bergoglio. One is Saint Therese of Lisieux, known in Spanish as Saint Teresita. Popular tradition holds that when Saint Teresita responds to a request, she sends roses. In the case of Bishop Bergoglio, she sends white roses. There are many stories about strangers handing him a white rose on the street or him finding white roses at his door, just as the problem is mysteriously solved. His devotion to Saint Joseph is expressed in part through a statue on his desk of sleeping Saint Joseph. In the Bible, Joseph, the husband of Mary, received God's directions while he slept. When Bishop Bergoglio, and now Pope Francis, has a particularly thorny problem, he writes it down and puts the paper under the statue of sleeping Saint Joseph. And soon, he says, he receives the solution. In 1997, Archbishop Quarantino was very ill. Again, over bitter opposition, he went directly to Pope John Paul II and had Bergoglio made his coadjutor, which is an assistant bishop with the right of succession. Quarantino died February 28, 1998. Bergoglio declined a formal installation ceremony. Instead of buying new vestments, he had Quarantino's cut down to fit him. He turned the archbishop's mansion into a priest's residence and turned an office at diocesan headquarters into a small apartment for himself. He did his own cooking. He gave up the archbishop's limousine, finding another job for its driver, and continued to take the bus. Ordinary people could talk to him on the bus about their problems and their ideas. He saw the biggest threat to the church as spiritual worldliness, a term coined by a theologian named Henri de Lubac. Basically, it means using the church for worldly gains and using it to manipulate others, obscuring Jesus in the process. He saw too much spiritual worldliness in Buenos Aires, including those who allowed the church to be used for money laundering. He set out to stop it. He brought in outside accountants and set up a system of such transparency and checks and balances that it was acclaimed across Latin America. The poor continued to be his greatest priority. Shortly after Pope Francis's election, I interviewed Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, the Emeritus Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who was too old to vote in the conclave but had urged the Americans to support Bergoglio. The globe-trotting McCarrick, specialist in international relief, had often visited Bergoglio in Buenos Aires. Usually, he told me, when he visited bishops in other dioceses, they showed him their great cathedrals, their famous works of art. Bergoglio took him to slum churches, extolling the ministries there. One of his innovations was the slum priest vicariate. That's its actual name. He started it after drug dealers threatened to kill a certain slum priest, Padre Pepe, who oversaw 13 parishes, 15 chapels, multiple soup kitchens, a drug prevention and recovery program, and many other ministries. When Padre Pepe reported that he had been ordered to leave the slums or die, Bergoglio responded, "We have to be calm because we are acting in accordance with the gospel. If someone has to die, it should be me. I will ask God to take me and not you." They decided that publicity was his best protection. The next day, at a mass for 7,000 teachers and students that was kind of a media event in itself, Bergoglio said that one of his priests had been threatened by, quote, the merchants of darkness, because his efforts to get people off drugs threatened the dealers. This made news. The next day, more than 350 of his priests signed a declaration of support for the slum priests. Padre Pepe gave a press conference. Thousands of people rallied in the street to support him, which got even more coverage. The next day, Bergoglio spent hours with Padre Pepe walking the streets in his neighborhoods. The story got worldwide coverage. Padre Pepe survived. When Bergoglio created the slum priest vicariate a few months later, he named Padre Pepe to head it. The vicariate engaged in dialogue and negotiations with public authorities, pressing for the same services that working-class neighborhoods received. They wanted the slum residents to be respected, integrated into wider civic life, and given a voice on city commissions. Bergoglio encouraged political engagement across party lines, no matter which party or philosophy held power. He clashed with almost all of them. In 2000, he began to hold meetings of civic and governmental leaders of all stripes in order to build relationships and find common ground to seek the common good. In 2001, Pope John Paul II made him a cardinal. Usually when somebody becomes a cardinal, there's like plane loads of people who go over to celebrate. Bergoglio told the Argentinians to stay home and spend their money on the poor instead. He stayed at a residence for international priests in downtown Rome and walked to the Vatican every day. Instead of visiting one of the tailors to have custom-made red vestments, which is normally almost like a ritual of becoming a cardinal, Bergoglio continued to wear his hand-me-downs. About 6 months later, he became coordinator of a synod of bishops on the ministry of bishops, replacing a cardinal who was called away for an emergency. He made an excellent impression on the other bishops because he listened to them and tried to synthesize all of their most important concerns. In the words of his biographer, Austin Iverly, the synod launched Bergoglio as a possible future pope. He returned to find Argentina in the worst economic crisis of its history. Banks were collapsing, the state was out of money, the president froze bank accounts to prevent a run and ordered police to fire on protesters who banged pots and pans in what was known as the Casserole Rebellion. Bergoglio saw the carnage from his window and protested vigorously. The president abdicated. The economy continued in crisis for another 2 years. Unemployment was nearly 50%. Formerly middle-class people scavenged at dumps. Children died of malnutrition. Marriages fell apart. The Catholic Church provided the principal social safety network. Bergoglio told his 186 parishes, 800 priests, 1,500 nuns and monks, and 1 million faithful to go into the streets and find people to help. Parishioners arrived at Mass carrying food for the poor. Churches stayed open at night for the homeless to sleep in. Church workers ran makeshift kitchens and medical clinics under bridges. Caritas ran job retraining programs. Bergoglio didn't try to sanction each project. He told people to quickly deliver aid to those in need, to place the person ahead of bureaucratic procedures. A Gallup poll at the time showed the church was the most trusted institution in Argentina. The new president in 2002, Eduardo Duhalde, was one of the few to have a healthy, cooperative relationship with the church. He worked with a plan that the Argentine bishops and United Nations officials had put forth months earlier to create a social safety network to start national dialogue and to start a national dialogue of leaders from all viewpoints built on civility and concern for the common good. Duhalde said later that Bergoglio was one of those who did the most to save Argentina from falling into total chaos. Duhalde's successors, Nestor and Cristina Kirchner, however, had a sort of an old, hard-left political heritage that was viscerally and politically hostile to the church. Bergoglio increasingly pressed the long-standing issue of government corruption entangled with organized crime. He exposed sweatshops and personally helped victims of sex trafficking get education, jobs, shelter, and other assistance. In 2005, a nightclub fire in Buenos Aires left 200 dead. Bergoglio immediately went to the scene, then the hospital, then the morgue. He anointed the dying, blessed the bodies of the dead, supported the bereaved. Government officials under whose watch egregious code violations had gone unaddressed were conspicuously absent. Bergoglio appointed one of his auxiliary bishops to organize a support team for the wounded and the grieving. On the 30th of each month, he celebrated a mass to commemorate the disaster and call for a change to the corruption and bribery that had allowed it to happen. By then, the Kirchners viewed Bergoglio as so much of a threat that they bugged his office. He knew this because the men assigned to monitor his conversations from a truck outside came to warn him. They all agreed that to preserve the men's job, he would always have a radio playing loud music so that no one could understand his conversations. By the mid-1990s, there was great discontent among the bishops worldwide. It wasn't aimed at John Paul personally, but at the Vatican bureaucracy that he had allowed to spiral out of control. Vatican bureaucrats routinely overruled local bishops on pastoral decisions that rightly belonged to the local bishops. A group of European bishops would informally discuss how to address this and who might be a worthy successor to John Paul. A few had their eyes on Bergoglio. John Paul died April 2, 2005. In the days before the conclave, there was enough talk about Bergoglio that an unknown party delivered anonymous letters to the cardinal electors repeating the claim that he had collaborated in the kidnapping and torture of two priests. The letters probably had little impact, as it was an obvious smear campaign, but it's known that he was running a strong second to Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger in the balloting until he told everyone to stop voting for him. Cardinal Ratzinger became Pope Benedict XVI. Over the next 8 years in Argentina, Bergoglio mounted a high-profile campaign against organized crime. He also excelled at ecumenical and interfaith relations. In 2012, he co-wrote a book with a rabbi about issues they disagreed on. The night he was elected pope, I got a call in Rome from Rabbi Alvin Birkin of Pittsburgh, who said, "Hey, I know this guy." He spoke of attending an international meeting of Catholic-Jewish dialogue in Buenos Aires, where he thought there would be a really cold reception because Argentina is not known for being particularly welcoming to Jews. Instead, he said, Bergoglio was totally committed to their concerns and his cathedral was home to the only Holocaust memorial in Buenos Aires. His extraordinary friendship with Protestant evangelicals, charismatics, and Pentecostals was a byproduct of his relationship with the Catholic charismatic movement. Early in his ministry, he had dismissed that movement, saying, "I thought they had confused the Holy Mass with a school of samba." But he came to appreciate the energy, love, and dedication to serving Jesus that flowed from the lives of most charismatics. As bishop, he celebrated an annual mass for the charismatic renewal in Argentina and spoke at their school of spiritual formation. There was a strong meeting of the minds and hearts over the need for the church to be out in the streets evangelizing. In 2003, a group of charismatic Protestant pastors and Catholic lay leaders formed an organization for shared prayer, mutual support, and training in evangelization. In 2006, they invited Father Raniero Cantalamessa, the Vatican's official preacher to the popes, to be the keynote speaker. So Bergoglio hosted the gathering in a small stadium packed with 7,000 people. Before Bergoglio spoke, he asked the other leaders to pray for him. He was photographed with his head bowed while Protestant pastors held their hands over him, asking the Holy Spirit to bless him with gifts of wisdom and leadership. The photo went viral in the religious world, drawing hostile reactions from Catholics who feared and hated what they called the sects, and Protestants who viewed the Catholic Church as the whore of Babylon. From then on, he prayed monthly with these pastors. They knew that Pope Benedict was strategizing for what the Catholic Church calls the new evangelization. They told Bergoglio bluntly that they didn't see how the Catholic Church could do that when, in their opinion, most of the priests lacked a personal relationship with Jesus. To their surprise, Bergoglio agreed, and he sought their help to evangelize his clergy. They brought Father Cantalamessa back from Rome for a conference in 2010. He had never seen anything like it. He said, "The whole world is watching very carefully what is happening in Buenos Aires." By then, Bergoglio had turned 75, the age at which all bishops must submit their resignations. But most aren't replaced for at least a year, and cardinals usually stay in office till they turn 80 and can no longer vote in a papal election. Pope Benedict had been elected pope at the age of 78. And in February 2013, the 85-year-old Benedict became the first pope in 600 years to resign. Most cardinals arrived for the conclave seeking a reformer, meaning a good administrator to clean up the power-mongering, scandal-plagued Vatican bureaucracy. But in an interview with me before the conclave, Cardinal Worrell summed up what proved to be the guiding wisdom. A pope can appoint others to run the administration. The church needed a pope whose gift and priority was evangelization. Bergoglio had bought a return ticket for March 23rd. Everyone who tries to predict papal elections discounted him because of his age. At a pre-conclave meeting, he described what the church should be like if it is to evangelize the world. quote, it must come out from itself and go into the peripheries, those of the mystery of sin, of suffering, of injustice, of ignorance, and lack of religion, to those in every kind of need. He continued that when the church fails to do so, quote, it becomes sick and self-referential, and he defined this as, quote, a kind of theological narcissism. In the book of Revelation, Jesus says that he is at the door and calling. Every time the text refers to him standing outside the door and knocking to be let in, but I sometimes think that Jesus is knocking from the inside for us to let him out. Cardinal Schönborn of Vienna, the kingmaker of the 2005 conclave, turned to the cardinal next to him and said, "This is what we need." Bergoglio returned to his room that night to find a white rose on his bed, the sign that St. Teresita was praying for him. Moments after his election on March 13, his good friend, Cardinal Claudio Hummes from Brazil, hugged him and said, "Don't forget the poor," which is how his thoughts turned to St. Francis of Assisi, also known as the Poverello, or poor man, who had renounced great wealth to follow Jesus, who evangelized the common people, loved all of creation, and tried to stop a war. "I will be called Francis," he said. So, next week, we learn what happened since. Do you have questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.